Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Last week, CERN announced that a new subatomic particle had been observed at the Large Hadron Collider after 50 years of searching for it. The discovery is important to our understanding of the strong interaction, one of the four fundamental interactions of nature. For over 40 years, MIT theoretical physicist and Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek has studied the strong interaction and the structure of our universe at the smallest scale. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, delves into how new discoveries like this are part of a long history of scientific quests for a beautiful order in nature. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Frank Wilczek back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
The CERN announcement said in part that pentaquark charmonium states must be formed of two up quarks, one down quark, one charm quark, and one anti-charm quark. Can that be translated into comprehensible English?
Well, we can put it in context, and then you can decide if it's comprehensible. The strongly interacting particles, of which protons and neutrons are the most practical examples, those are what atomic nuclei and ultimately we are made out of. But the protons and neutrons are only two examples of a much wider class of structures that we understand are made out of more fundamental things that obey much simpler principles and equations called quarks and gluons. Now, all the particles basically that have been studied up until now, and there are hundreds of them, conform to two body planes. There are things called baryons that are made from three quarks, and there are things called mesons that are made from a quark and an antiquark. There are also antibaryons, but the same idea. Now, this would be a new body plan that the quarks could organize themselves into.
Do we keep on getting smaller and smaller? I remember when Murray Gell-Mann was here, and he talked about coming up with the idea of the quark, but that seemed to be the smallest thing at the time.
Well, as far as we know, quarks are basically ideal mathematical points in the equations. They acquire structure because quantum mechanical particles are described by probability clouds, but as objects, they are points. Now, we've discovered more things since those days. We had gluons emerging from understanding how the forces between quarks work. That was my contribution. But they're not in any real sense smaller. They're just different.
How does this CERN discovery connect with your work? Or
well,
does it?
Oh, it very much does. And the fact that you get from the fundamental description, quantum chromodynamics, that's the equations that I found, to these two body plans is not at all obvious and, in fact, is not very well understood why those two body plans are so dominant. Although we can solve these equations accurately in some circumstances, the behavior of quarks at low energies when they form these protons and neutrons and other strongly interacting particles is very difficult to calculate. And so we need the help of experiment to guide us in getting the consequences of these equations. And it's very interesting that the experiments are coughing up these new body plans. There actually was a false alarm about pentaquarks, this kind of thing, several years ago that inspired quite a bit of work, including by me. And
a false alarm in what way?
Well, there was a supposed discovery of something with this body plan that was very dramatic. But several different experimental groups around the world claimed to confirm it, but other ones couldn't find this particle. And make a long story short, eventually it was discredited. But now this is not the same particle. This is a different particle, but the same kind of body plan. And the ideas, I think, that we were exploring in the earlier incarnation, which had very great difficulty in describing what they supposedly were seeing, which in retrospect looks really good because they weren't seeing it. They look much better, I think, in this context therefore the world that we thought we had before we may get now, and it'll be very interesting. It'll teach us also about the forces that are operative in protons and neutrons and about matter in it. It'll improve our understanding, give us a whole new world to explore.
You shared the Nobel Prize with David Gross and David Pulitzer for your work on asymptotic freedom, a feature of quantum chromodynamics. Can asymptotic freedom be described for people who might find high school physics intimidating?
It's actually, yes. It's very simple to understand, to define if your standards are low enough. So basically, it's the phenomenon that the force between quarks gets weaker at short distances or at high energies, but gets stronger as you go to larger distances or consider interactions at low energy.
That seems counterintuitive.
It's very counterintuitive. It's very hard to make a theoretical description that has that property that is consistent with other basic principles of quantum theory and relativity. In fact, it's so hard that it was by finding theories that embodied that property that we were led to a unique theory of the strong interaction, which is called quantum chromodynamics, which we introduced gluons so that this could happen. And it's had a glorious triumphant history since then.
Well, often people come up with an idea, there's got to be this thing.
Yes.
And then we don't know if it actually does exist until experiments many years later. The CERN Large Hadron Collider has been very helpful, hasn't it?
The CERN Hadron Collider, the Large Hadron Collider in particular, sort of has been operating just the last few years.
So or other colliders,
for us,
anyway.
Other colliders have been very important. The story that's meant a lot to me is that in the early days, when people were doing experiments using our theory, it was called testing quantum chromodynamics or testing asymptotic freedom. Now, when they do the same sort of thing, it's called calculating backgrounds. So this now is so accepted that it's used as a kind of background that people want to say, that's understood, we want to find new things. So we'll rely on that part and look for small discrepancies. And that's the way, for instance, the Higgs particle was found at the LHC. It would have been completely inconceivable if you didn't understand what happens most of the time, which is the strong interaction, which is quantum chromodynamics, to find these rare events that correspond to the new physics, the Higgs particle. I like to say it's like if you want to find a needle in a haystack, you have to understand hay very well.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, who understands hay very well. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, it's published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned earlier attempts to find some kind of grand unified theory. Does this discovery help in that effort?
The pentaquarks, not particularly. The Higgs particle, yes. The pentaquarks will add to our understanding of the equations we have, but won't lead to fundamentally new equations.
String theory is an attempt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, string. Well, there are a big goal of the next generation of experiments, sort of gearing up at the LHC, is to see whether ideas that extend our current understanding is usually called the standard model. I like to call it the core theory. Whether those ideas, which are inspired by trying to make the equations more beautiful, more compelling, more unified, whether those are correct.
We'll come back to that beautiful in just a moment. But in speaking to string theorists, I've often been confused. They keep on coming up with a different number of dimensions that are necessary. And then that whole issue of whether string theory is even something that is testable. Do you think that the Large Hadron Collider will provide a way to test string theory one way or the other?
I would be very surprised, because the theory as yet hasn't been mature enough to give concrete predictions. There could be encouragement if something called supersymmetry is discovered. That's something that string theory uses as a kind of building block, but it can be motivated on other grounds. So that would be encouragement, but not proof. It would be a big step forward in any case.
Why are physicists so interested in unification? The world seems to be working quite well with these two theories that have both been proven to be true, even if they're slightly irreconcilable.
Are you speaking of quantum mechanics and gravity?
Yes.
Well, actually, there are more theories. There's also the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. And I think the conflict between gravity and quantum mechanics is overstated. I mean, and the other interactions. The astrophysicists routinely deal with situations in which gravity is operated, and so is quantum mechanics. And they're very successful using the laws of physics. However, the general quest for unification is an important quest. I would say there are two reasons why we especially seek unification of different forces that seem superficially quite different. One is that it's had a glorious history. In the past, for instance, when Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism, he found that the unified theory predicted new phenomena, which are phenomena that today we call radio, infrared radiation, microwaves. You know, today we cook with them and communicate with them. So that was extremely fruitful, and it gave a new understanding of light. And there have been other episodes like that, when unifying diverse things, just as an aesthetic enterprise, turned out to give great fruit. The other reason, besides that it's fruitful, is just that it's pretty. And what else are we going to do? We need to have some thing that drives the quest for getting a better description of nature. And trying to get a unified description has one guess for how that might work that's been fruitful in the past. And there seems to be a lot of circumstantial evidence that we can make a few more steps.
Was Maxwell searching for unification, or was it more of a flash of insight that he realized had the effect of unifying?
Well, he was searching for a unification of the laws of electricity and magnetism. So at that time, the understanding of electricity and magnetism was still partial. There were important links between them. People knew that electric currents produce magnetic fields, and Faraday's law that changing magnetic fields produce electric fields. What Maxwell wanted to do was make a systematic, complete understanding of electricity and magnetism. So in that sense, he was seeking a unification of the diverse laws that were known at that time. What he found, however, is that when he tried to do that, he got an inconsistency. He figured out how to fix that, though, in a simple way that seemed very beautiful and compelling. And when he did that, he found, as an unexpected gift, that disturbances in the electric and magnetic fields could take on a life of their own, move around, that they would move around at the speed of light. And so Maxwell said, that is light. And that was a completely unexpected, glorious unification of electricity, magnetism, and light.
You keep on using these words, pretty and beautiful. The big question you ask in your book is, does the universe embody beautiful ideas?
Yes.
Can you give an example of an idea in quantum chromodynamics or another area of modern physics that you find particularly beautiful?
Well, a common theme in our understanding of the fundamental laws and that have been so successful, and especially in the last part of the 20th century, and the way we guess them, in fact, is by hoping that they embody a principle of symmetry. Now, symmetry, as used in mathematics and physics, is a special concept. It's the concept you can change things without changing them. So, for instance, a circle, which as we call is very symmetric intuitively, in this definition is also symmetric because you can rotate a circle by any angle, and although the different points move, so it's changed, the circle as a whole does not. Now, the virtue of that kind of exotic-seeming definition is that it's precise and can be generalized. So you can speak of symmetry of equations if their equations allow transformations of the different quantities that don't change their content, or symmetries of or physical law, if you can transform things without changing the law.
So the symmetries are what make things beautiful? Can
well,
we have things in that work well but are also ugly?
Well, I mean, symmetry has worked well, amazingly well, because the symmetries that we need, that we postulate in quantum chromodynamics, for instance, are extraordinarily large amounts of symmetry. The equations allow many, many kinds of transformations that are amazing, that leave their content invariant. So, and that's how we arrived at them. Now, there are, however, loose ends. And one way that I and my colleagues are trying to improve the description of nature is by making more symmetric equations. So one way of making more symmetric equations to make them reverse, have the same properties in going forward in time and backwards in time, leads to a particle called axions, which might be the dark matter of the universe. Another way of making the equations more symmetric and beautiful makes the strong electromagnetic and weak interactions all derive from one fundamental interaction at short distances. That requires supersymmetry, which again brings in new particles. So these lead to testable consequences. And I'm hoping that trust in beauty as a guide to the way nature should behave will actually teach us how nature does behave. And the jury is out. The experiments are being done, but we'll find out soon.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, Wilczek, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. He's written a number of books. His most recent, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design. It's published by Penguin Press. We'll continue a conversation after this. We're back with Frank Wilczek. His latest book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, is published by Penguin Press. I want to get back to this whole thing about beauty. Don't some physical constants like the speed of light or Planck's constant extend to many decimal places? Would that be considered ugly?
You mean that?
I mean,
what
to
else
just go on and on and on.
The way that those are defined, when I think of Planck's constant, or when I think of the speed of light, I think of them as being equal to one. Planck's constant defines the unit of action, the thing that it, the kind of dimension it has. The speed of light, it's easier to talk about in terms of the speed of light. The speed of light is a velocity. If you measure velocities in terms of that fundamental velocity, then the speed of light is just one. So for a physicist, all those decimal places are not important. They just have to do with the fact that you're defining it in terms of seconds and centimeters, and those things are very unnatural. Those are just conventions. What's the important thing, the fundamental thing, is the speed of light itself. And in practice, we always just set it to one and measure velocities in those units.
Your colleague David Gross described the ugly parts as those that, quote, describe the strange spectrum of matter, and he added that it was the lack of beauty with a large number of unexplained parameters that leads many to believe that the end of the story has not been reached. How far has the story been advanced since he wrote that in 1988?
I think that what's happened since 1988 is mostly that we've discovered how good our description of nature that we saw at that time is. Many people, including myself, who didn't anticipate that the ideas that we hatched in the the 70s and the early 80s would hold up as well as they have. And experimentalists have tried very, very hard to find exceptions, to find new phenomena at higher energies or in precise measurements. But so far, the basic framework has held up remarkably well. There are a couple of major loose ends. One is that the astronomers, meanwhile, have found dark matter, have found a form of matter that's not within our core theory or standard model. Another thing that's happened is that they found dark energy, which is yet another thing that's not in our standard model or is can be accommodated, but is kind of strange. And the discovery of the Higgs particle was kind of the last missing piece of the theory we had before. So it was a wonderful confirmation of previous ideas. Now,
I've always wondered what would happen if we weren't able to discover the Higgs boson.
Well, there were plenty of proposals for things that might have been there instead of extra dimensions or warped things or technicolor. There are many proposals or more complicated versions with several Higgs particles. But what's happened is the kind of very minimal implementation of the job that the Higgs particle was supposed to do has turned out to be the correct description so far of what experimentists have found. So basically what's happened, I would say, since David's statement, is that the situation has sharpened. We now know that the laws, the beautiful laws that we saw at that time work very, very well. The ugly parts still are ugly. there are loose ends. But aesthetics, to me, is the guide, the most promising guide to what will happen next. And so I'm hoping that the axion and that supersymmetry, which are both inspired by aesthetic completions of what we know now, will turn out to be the next wave of discoveries.
Most people associate physics with mathematics, but are the ideas you discuss in your book necessarily mathematical?
Well, they're mathematical in the sense that they're precise. However, I've not put in any equations. I've tried to, and I think succeeded, in describing them all in visual terms. So, for instance, even the Maxwell equations, which are famously complicated with partial differential equations or integrals and so forth, you can put in with complete justice and accuracy in simple visual terms. And I worked very hard to do that. I learned how to draw using Keynote and made the figures and had, more importantly, thought of the concepts that would be necessary to bring it into pictures. And even in the case of QCD, which is kind of Maxwell's equations on steroids, I've used imagery, color, tried to use the overwhelming abilities of humans as visual creatures to understand the concepts in ways that are intensely visual as opposed to abstract algebra.
An MIT colleague of yours, Max Tegmark, has argued that reality is mathematics. Do you share his view?
No. Reality is reality, and mathematics is mathematics. And there are, of course, some quite remarkable correspondences between parts of mathematics and parts of reality. But there's certainly not an identity between the two as far as I can tell. That's kind of mystical.
How is a physicist's notion of beauty like the common notion of beauty that we have when we talk about art or music?
Well, one thing I've tried to document in A Beautiful Question, which in fact to me is the main burden of the book, is to show that properly understood, when you put it in visual terms, when you analyze the conceptual core of our fundamental understanding of the world in terms of symmetry and also what I call exuberance, the idea that you get more out than you put in, that there's an economy of means, that those are powerful themes that you, and also playing with color, by the way, that those are powerful themes that you find in the history of art and philosophy as well. These are kinds of ideas that were anticipated by Pythagoras and Plato. It's how they hoped the world would work and guessed. They made crude guesses for how these ideas might work. And artists have embodied it in decorative art especially. They use rich patterns of symmetry. And perspective is a form of symmetry that artists took great pride and joy in using and is essentially a mathematical discovery.
Golden mean.
There's the golden mean. So for me, it was really a revelation when I started thinking hard about this, how much there's in common between what people have found beautiful in the it's objective, it's not subject. You can look at what the historical record is. What did people find beautiful and compare it with the basic principles of how the world works? Of course, not everything that people find beautiful is how the world works, and not everything about how the world works is beautiful, but there's enormous overlap. There's enormous commonality in those two things.
But art history reveals to us that what people find beautiful in the 15th century is different from what they find beautiful in the 17th century, and again, what we find beautiful in the 21st century. You do have color plates, some rather beautiful color plates in this book, including some by William Blake, and you quote Blake, "If the doors of perception could be cleansed, then man would see the world as it is, infinite."
Yes. Well, one thing that careful study and scientific study of nature reveals is that our sensory apparatus is profoundly limited. And in some sense, this is well known. We don't see really small things. We need to use microscopes. We can't see really far away things. We need to use telescopes. However, the more you understand about how rich the underlying structure of the world is, the more you appreciate how much our perception of it leaves on the table. So in particular, our sense of vision is based on three color receptors, which are all in a certain part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And in principle, the electromagnetic spectrum, which is light, is a continuum, so you could support many, many more. You could also have infrared, ultraviolet, polarization. There's much that we leave on the table. And if we could clean up or enhance our perception, there's much more to the world than meets the eye. So Blake was absolutely right about that.
Physicists talk about color gluons.
Yes. Well, that was a joke originally, but it's actually an extremely profound metaphor that I've used heavily, because human vision being the trichromatic means that it's all the colors we see can be synthesized from three basic underlying colors. That's the principle of color television, computer displays, color photography, color printing. You can use three basic elements to get any perceived color. And it turns out that there are three different properties you need to specify the properties of quarks and the different kinds of charges there are in quantum chromodynamics. So the name is profoundly resonant. And as I've explored the use of color as a metaphor for the strong interaction, it's almost uncanny how much of the physical nature of color can be mapped on to the perception of color if you use your imagination.
Getting back to the word beauty, were thinkers like Kepler or Galileo or Newton inspired by ideas about the beauty of the natural world?
Yes, definitely. Kepler, most obviously. Kepler's career in astronomy was based on a model that he thought was extremely beautiful, that we now know is entirely wrong, but it inspired him, based on he wanted to understand the size and shape of the solar system. So he thought that the planets revolved around on spherical carriers and had circular orbits. And to determine the size of those carriers, what you would do is use the Platonic solids, these embodiments of symmetry that Plato had admired and made as models of atoms long before, use those as interpolating objects between the different celestial spheres. And to get them to fit, you need the spheres to be of a certain relative size. And Kepler thought, convinced himself, that that's what determined the number of planets and also the size and shape of their orbits.
So much of how we understood the world was based on Euclidean geometry for a long time. And then non-Euclidean geometry is developed in the 19th century. How can you, does that mean that points can meet in infinity?
Well, to me, the real discovery of non-Euclidean geometry was in 1420 by the artist-engineer Brunelleschi, who made the science of perception, of perspective, I'm sorry.
Yes, he came up with it, then Masaccio applied it, and history, and art history has never been the same.
That's right, and in perspective, parallel lines do meet. They meet. And if you look at a canvas and look at a picture, an accurate picture of railroad tracks, for instance, they meet at the horizon. It's a real place on the canvas. So this kind of art of perspective leads to a branch of geometry that's very well developed. It's called projective geometry. That's extremely beautiful. That's non-Euclidean.
And without it, we wouldn't have modern mathematics.
We certainly wouldn't have the Renaissance art or modern mathematics. It's an important part of modern mathematics. It also, by the way, is a profound embodiment of symmetry in this sense of change without change, because it's the precise science of how you can change images of a given object by looking at them from different vantage points.
We don't have much time, but you keep on coming back to symmetry, and as I understand it, people are attracted to physically to other people if their faces, for example, are symmetrical. So this is pretty basic to human perception.
I think it is, and I think one reason we find symmetry beautiful is that evolution encourages us to find things that help us find our way around the world, or, as you say, to find desirable mates that are healthy, to find them beautiful. They stimulate our dopamine system, and that really, as a physiological level, is the source of beauty.
Frank Wilczek will be in conversation with Glenys Farrar at Pioneer Works for the series Scientific Controversies tonight at 7:30 p.m. That's at 159 Pioneer Street in Brooklyn. You can find out more information on our show page at WNYC.org. His book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Penn and Teller have been debunking magic for 40 years now, even as they have been amazing and mystifying us with their tricks. Why do they remain so compelling, the tricks of the performers, even after they sometimes show us how it's all done? They're back on Broadway for the first time in 25 years, and this time they literally pull a rabbit out of a hat. Penn and Teller on Broadway is playing at the Marquee Theater until August 16th, so you only have a few weeks to see them before they disappear. Joining us now to talk about the show and their remarkable career is Penn Jillette, the vocal member of the team. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.
What happened to the BS that's usually prominently featured in the titles of your various shows?
Oh, what do you mean? We did BS on Showtime for 8 years.
Is this a non-BS shows. Version?
What do you mean? I don't understand.
I don't know. Just a bad joke. I see you as the quintessential New York magician, wry, skeptical, intelligent. What in the world have you been doing in Las Vegas for the past 15 years?
You know, I don't know. We've actually been out there a little over 20, and we've had our own theater out there for 14 years, the Penn and Teller. I guess 15 years now, the Penn and Teller Theater. I believe you're either in New York or you're someplace else. You know, I love New York. And when you tell your theater friends after you've played Broadway a couple times and off Broadway a bunch of times, when you tell your New York friends you're going to move to Vegas, it's a little like being a painter and telling your painter friends, from now on, I'm going to paint exclusively on velvet with day-glow paint, and my subjects will be just Elvis and Jesus sweating and crying respectively. That's all I will do. But Vegas does have the advantage of you can have a theater with more freedom than you have in New York. In New York, you have to getting a long run means you kind of have to follow tradition. You have to stay with that show. I mean, if we closed both our Broadway runs while they were successful, but if we had continued, we're really not supposed to do big changes in the show. Whereas in Vegas, we change the show whenever we want, not from boredom, but just because Teller and I write so much stuff. We like to get up on stage.
But I wonder how audiences react to the fact that you're pretty outspoken about your libertarian ideas in your act. Are they okay with it there?
You know, the thing that we often forget if we get our information from the media is that America is really committed to being able to have different ideas. I am an atheist and a rather outspoken atheist. And there is a huge following of Christians that come to see the Penn and Teller show. And they like the magic tricks. They like the passion. And libertarianism is kind of similar. We have lots of liberal and conservative Democrat and Republican fans. And I think that's okay. You know, as an atheist, I listen to gospel music. You know, I enjoy gospel music very, very much. I enjoy hymns very, very much. And I think that there's people on the other side that can do the same thing.
You know, I used to be a gospel DJ.
Did you really?
Yeah.
How'd that work out for you?
You're not doing it now. Some wonderful music.
Yeah.
No, we do it once in a while on our show here. Maybe Vegas is a good place because people are all so involved with self-deception as it is.
I suppose. You know, it is a town built on the big, broad, brawny shoulders of bad math. But what I love about Vegas is the fact that the people that we work for don't care about us.
Your
at
act
all.
Isn't a traditional magic act. How would you describe it?
Well, you know, we do tricks that no one can figure out, which is what Houdini's definition was. And I think we do tricks as good as anybody. The big difference is being on a par with the audience. Jerry Seinfeld once said that every magic act is, here's a quarter, now it's gone, you're a jerk, now it's back, you're an idiot, show's over. We try to always treat our audience with respect, and that is probably the most radical thing you can do in magic. In magic, you're supposed to either go, ha-ha, I can do this and you can't, or you're supposed to say, I have real powers, which is even more insulting.
But you're saying we are doing tricks.
Yeah.
Understand that they're tricks, but you're still going to be...
Sure, I think that's really pretty a wonderful way, to be honest. You know, it became fashionable in the 70s to stop using the word tricks and to use the word illusions. Mm-hmm. And illusion to me is a term of art within magic that means something that's a visual illusion, that the prop does the work. Trick is a much more intellectual area because trick means you're using the word. I mean, if you wanted to really explore what magic is, it's a playful study of epistemology.
You mentioned Houdini. He was interested in debunking people who claimed that they could do real magic. More recently, the amazing Randy has done it, and the two of you have been interested in that as well.
Well, you know, Randy's
are the people in the magic business who get upset?
Yes. There are many people in magic who believe that part of a magician's job is to dupe people about reality. And they think that claiming supernatural powers is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. As a matter of fact, David Blaine will make the argument and has made the argument, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'll try to represent what he said to me as accurately as I can. He believes that part of a magician's job is to distort reality out in the real world. That is appalling to me. And as much as I like David Blaine as a person and appreciate his work, we disagree very strongly on that issue.
You also did more than debunk magic on your Showtime series. You debunked a lot of different things. Were you ever sued?
I know
lawyers got involved.
Oh, no. We had the best lawyers in the world. And one of the things that saved us was obscenity. If you call someone a liar, they will take you to court. If you call them a four-letter word, yeah, it's a little harder. So they used to put in the margins, can you use obscenity here? And so we had a lot of the obscenity thrust upon us. Not that I was unwilling.
But you did metaphors of a sort. Chiropractors probably didn't appreciate when you brought on ducks because you couldn't say the word
quack. We couldn't say the word quack, so we filled the whole stage with ducks, yeah. Ducks, it turns out, can say the word quack.
Now, I would think that...
And little else.
I would think that three-card Monty players don't appreciate you. The last time you were on Broadway, you revealed how the ball under one of three cups routine
Yeah, and
works.
We also did a series of... This is way back in the late 80s, early 90s. We did a series of PSAs about three-card Monty, which is less popular now. And I was... some of the guys found me after a show and spit on me and pushed me around. I can't really say they beat me up, but they hurt me. You know, not badly. I wasn't hospitalized, but I really didn't enjoy it. It turns out people that spit on you are not the people you want to spit on you. It's not Scarlett Johansson spitting on you.
I'm not sure I even want her to spit on me.
I am sure.
Penn Jillette is here. We're talking about the latest show of Penn & Teller. It's called Penn & Teller on Broadway. It's at the Marquee Theater and will be running only until August 16th.
Yeah, that's a hard out, you know, because we have the Penn & Teller Theater in Vegas. And you know, people have asked why it took us so long to get back to Broadway. And the answer is we wanted to come back every year. We've been working on this deal for 15 years. The problem is when they name a theater after you and they paint your picture on the side of the hotel 300 feet tall and you tell them you want to leave the city and leave the theater empty for 6 weeks, there's a certain amount of persuading and dancing one must do.
Well, I would imagine that Doug Henning is willing to fill the... your place for a while.
Except for that being dead thing.
Oh, well, that hurts. Is there a particular temperament that suits being a magician? Because you and Teller seem to be quite different temperamentally.
Yeah, we're very different temperaments and very different lifestyles, but we agree on everything philosophically and we disagree on everything artistically. And I think that's, if you're in a partnership with someone you agree with, get out of that partnership. You can't be better than yourself working with yourself.
You've said that you and Teller basically are performing one-man shows.
Yeah. Well, there's a big difference there. If you think of any comedy team, whether you're talking about Martin and Lewis or Cheech and Chong, or whether you're talking about Rowan and Martin, or whether you're talking about Abbott and Costello, they essentially have three quarters to the audience, and they talk to one another while the audience watches. Even if, like the Smothers Brothers, they're aware of the audience, they're still looking in on a conversation. Mom always liked you best. I didn't know whatever you're doing. We have never done that. As a matter of fact, there is, I think, one sentence in the entire show that I address to Teller, and that is, are you set? Everything else I say out to the audience. And Teller is also out to the audience. So it very much is, there's interaction between us, but only with the audience as an intermediary.
The whole show is scripted?
Yes.
You're saying the same thing every night?
Yes, unless, of course, something merits, plan the dive the plan, but you have to still be ready if something goes different. We have about three dozen audience members on stage during the show, so things will change night to night.
And none of them are setups?
No, none. I say in the show, jokingly, that it's too expensive But it really is. To lose those seats, you know, we're very close to sold out every show. We don't want prime seats to put people in that aren't paying. And we also, we don't want to pay people to be there. And also, no one is a good enough actor. You can be a good enough actor to play a part on stage. Playing an audience member is a whole different thing. And I'll give you a little hint. If you're watching a magic show and you wonder if someone might be a plant, watch them go up the stairs. Because plants go upstairs carefully, like they've never seen stairs before. They don't want to be too familiar. When you bring someone up from the audience that's really from the audience, they are excited and they know what stairs are. They'll take them two at a time and run on stage. Plants never will.
Is it helpful to do a two-person magic show in that some of the tricks depend on diverting the audience's attention?
Diversion never works. It doesn't work in any situation. It's not part of magic. But what does work is doing four-handed what was done two-handed is very, very deceptive. If I do what's called a French drop, which is holding something in my right hand, appearing to take it with my left hand, but actually retaining it in the right hand, unless that's done perfectly, you can get a sense that one person could be doing what's called a pass or the French drop. If two people do that, if Teller's holding something in his hand and I reach over and take it from him, you've never seen someone do that move. So we use it a lot. As a matter of fact, one of the really heavy tricks we did on Letterman with a watch involved a two-person French drop, which we also use it in the
Cups
and
Bowls. That
was
the one where you smashed the watch.
Yeah, it was.
But you do divert us with the cow becoming an elephant trick and then the video trick.
Well, your definition of diverting is different than
mine. It's okay. Your partner does a trick where he swallows needles and then pulls them out of his mouth threaded on a long string. Is that the trick you first saw him do?
Yeah. Emotionally, artistically, yes. Factually, probably not. I believe when I first met Teller, he might have done a few card tricks and a few little things, which is why I say in the show on stage. But it's the first trick I saw him do on stage. And it's a takeoff, and by the way, a better version of a trick that Houdini did. And I say better version with a great deal of confidence because we've had so far four people who saw Houdini do the trick and saw Teller do the trick. Because Houdini stopped performing in 1926. He died Halloween 1926. So there are people who could have seen. My mother saw Houdini and saw Teller.
Has anyone guessed how it's done?
Guessed is an odd verb. There are people that know some of the methodology, although it is originally Teller's method. There's two things in magic. There's the effect and the method. The effect is what it looks like, and the method is how you do it. The effect of the needles is Houdini's. The method is Teller's.
Hmm. Well, I wonder whether your show isn't as much about ideas as it is about magic.
I would like it to be, but we try to think very, very hard about what we want to say. You know, a lot of magic books will tell you, you know, take a standard trick and paint it differently and you have a different trick. We don't go for that. Of course, the other thing is, you know, Teller and I have written enough material and Vegas has enough of a turnover that we don't need to write any new material for the rest of our lives in terms of commerce. So we do it strictly artistically. So the stuff we're doing now, we are doing stuff just because it's hard. Not to compare it to John F. Kennedy saying we go to the moon, but we are doing stuff just because it's difficult.
So it is hard, because I always wondered
really
whether
hard stuff.
It's easier than I would imagine it is.
No. The whole trick to magic is just we're willing to work harder than you believe we would. We work the number of hours put in. It's usually for our show about a year a minute for new stuff that goes in, a year a minute.
The only sad thing about you being on radio is we can't show what you do. But is it fair to say that Teller is more of a traditional magician? You're more of a showman?
Oh, I don't know. Teller's one of the finest showmen I've ever seen.
Because I heard that you first wanted to be a rock star.
Well, no, I was a big fan of rock and roll, but didn't have the talent or the looks.
Then you studied to be a clown.
Yeah, I went to Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey, the greatest show on earth, Clown College. But what I really started out as was a juggler. And I was a juggler in philosophical opposition to magic. I was very against an art form that dealt with lying. So we are very conscientious, very conscientious about making sure people don't leave the theater with false information.
On the other hand, because you say that it's all just trickery, or whatever word you want to use, when some of those things are almost impossible to figure out, that makes them feel even more magical.
I would like to think so, yeah.
You start off with a trick with a cell phone, and there's no way I can figure out how you did
thing. Thank you. Yeah, that's pretty complicated. That uses some pre-existing principles, but there's some nice twist in it, and I think we do it well.
And some of them are kind of beautiful, like when Teller turns coins into goldfish.
Yeah, that's a nice one. I like the visual on that a lot.
And then there's another one about where it seems like you're cutting the shadow of of a flower,
it's
the flower is actually falling apart. Almost impossible to understand.
It's a nice depiction of what's called sympathetic magic, voodoo.
So is there a difference between illusion and a trick?
I believe that because of Doug Henning and David Copperfield in the 70s, it got very, very distorted. They started calling everything illusion. But I like to use it very strictly and say that an illusion really doesn't involve any mental work on the part of the magician. It's just it looks that way.
I'm speaking with Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller. Their show Penn and Teller on Broadway is at the Marquee Theater and running until August 16th, and then they will return to Las Vegas.
Yeah, we'll go right back the next week.
Now, there's that whole matter of pulling a rabbit out of a hat, which has become almost, as you point out in the show, associated with magicians. Now, you do it.
What I say in the show is true. You know, Teller and I were talking backstage in England. Teller had gone out to lunch with another magician and came back and said they were discussing how the rabbit out of the hat is a cliched trick, and yet they'd never seen it because it's so, so hard.
So did you have to figure out how to do it
yourself? Oh, yeah. Not only did we figure – we didn't really figure it out ourselves. Johnny Thompson, who's the greatest magic mind alive and who works for us, he did an act called The Great Tom Sony that opened for Sinatra and everybody in Vegas. Genius in magic. As far as I can tell, Johnny's 80. And as far as I can tell, his total recall. And he can tell you every magician and every trick they did and how everything was done. We brought Johnny in. We brought Amazing Randy in. We brought Piff the Magic Dragon, who's a young magician who's wonderful. And we sat and, you know, we brought them in and said, okay, guys, we got a really hard one for you. We're going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. Now, the stakes have gotten harder. In the 19th century, when that became a cliche, it was a much easier trick because we did not have respect for life. So the rabbit could be treated very, very badly.
And is do you have to deal with animal rights groups?
No, because we're spotless. We the animals are treated perfectly in our show.
You also have the disappearing elephant, which is really a cow.
Hey! It's an elephant.
Okay, I mean it isn't like I'm revealing anything.
I didn't come here to be insulted. It's an elephant.
Now the two of you have maintained a relationship of 40 years. That seems magical.
Yeah, that doesn't seem right, does it? I think the reason we've been able to do that is most show business relationships are based on love. Clearly, Lennon and McCartney fell in love with one another. So as soon as things start going even slightly badly, there's heartbreak involved. Teller and I start our relationship based on respect. And it turns out respect lasts longer than affection. And Teller and I don't have a particular amount of – I mean, that's not true. After 40 years, you know, my daughter gets very upset when she hears these interviews. She's 10 years old. She hears these interviews. She always says to people, you have to tell people on the radio that Teller is your BFF because he is your BFF. And I guess Teller is my BFF. But our relationship is very businesslike and based on respect.
And people are curious
about it.
But
Moxie, he's my BFF.
The Wall Street Journal recently did an interview with each of you separately asking you how the other one would respond to a list of questions. It's kind of like the newlywed game for magic partners. And you got all of them correct. Was that?
Did I? I never even checked on that. That's great.
I guess that's another form of magic, isn't it? But you must have conflicts at times.
We have conflicts constantly. We only argue, you know, neither one of us ever does drugs. Neither one of us ever has even a sip of wine. We agree completely on money. We are never late for our meetings. Teller never makes a mistake on stage. Everything he does is perfect, and then we disagree on everything artistic. Every word in the show was fought over. Every move in the show was fought over. And we find if we can please both of us, we can please a lot of audience members.
It would help probably if mind reading was really a possibility.
Yeah, except that all physics breaks down and all Nobel Prizes are then void.
Was he doing a silent act when you met
yes.
him?
Teller working silently predates working with Penn and Teller. He worked his way through college doing magic at frat parties, which is the inner layer of Dante's hell, the inner circle. And he found that if he remained quiet, people grew weary of heckling him.
He didn't like that audience. So Ricky Jay, who's been on a show a few times, has said he doesn't allow kids to his shows.
Yeah, well, that's Ricky.
But...
We're okay with children.
Can a kid appreciate it? Well, you have lots of kids at your show.
We do. We do have some. And, you know, we want them to be with parents. And we want them to be, you know, they have to be well-behaved and so on. It is an adult show, but the subject is not sex. So for some people, that means not adult.
Much has been said recently about the incident at a theater recently where Patti LuPone took a cell phone out of an audience.
Yeah, the first line of our show is turn your cell phones on. And...
But what about that when the cell phones go off in the middle of a show? You're really focused.
It's the 21st century. It's going to happen. You know, people have, you know, there's people with young children at home and babysitters, and there's people that are doing important stuff. They can't be expected to suspend their whole life because I'm doing a stupid show. I mean, they should be polite to the people around them, but it's not the end of the world.
Well, after you do that first act where you have everybody keep their cell phone on, you don't ask them to turn it off. Is this the libertarian in you?
It's not just that. It's also that once you've called attention to it, I think everybody does. I believe after telling everyone in the theater to turn their cell phones on, we aren't interrupted any more than people who beg people to turn them off. So I don't know if it's libertarian, if it's laissez-faire, if it's just accepting of reality.
Now... There aren't film and technology the enemy of magic?
Not the enemy in any way, but they are certainly not the ally. Magic is still the only form that you can't get most of the effect electronically. I mean, as much as I wanted to see Sinatra, and I did see Sinatra, as much as I wanted to see Elvis and didn't see Elvis, as much as I wanted to see Bob Dylan and continue to see Bob Dylan all the time, much of what they do is recorded electronically and pretty accurately. As a matter of fact, many people would argue that some of those people are better on record than they are live. Magic cannot be translated electronically because you have to feel it viscerally in the room.
Our next guest, Little Anthony of Little Anthony and the Imperials, watched George Foreman fight with Elvis Presley. So
did he really?
Yeah. So I guess you should have been a doo-wop singer.
why would you think I wanted to watch George Foreman fight? And why do you think I want to be in a room with Elvis Presley?
Just one more, because you kind of suggest that. Could a mediocre magician make a good living as a criminal?
No. I mean...
Because magicians often do pickpocket things.
Yeah, but never the same. You know, there's this horrible thing that happens. And David Mamet, who's one of my favorite writers, accidentally contributes to this by acting like scams that are run are really clever. And they're not. The scams you read about, the pigeon drop, all those things that are so witty when you read about them in a Mamet play, when they're actually done in the real world, they involve beating up elderly people. That's all there really is. So a criminal does not accomplish what they accomplish. You mentioned pickpockets. That clever little reaching into the pocket does not exist. They cut people open with razor blades and take away what they have. Criminals, if you don't fall for their clever little thing, will stab you. What is required to be a criminal is a lack of morality, not an intelligence.
Just one more thing before you go.
Okay.
I usually think of magic acts as being done in intimate spaces. You're working in this huge Broadway theater. That must affect the kinds of things that you can do.
You pick stuff that's bigger, although I think you'll find, I mean, many people have said that the final monologue I give by candlelight is a fairly intimate experience. I believe that intimacy has to do with the heart and honesty and not just volume of space.
Penn and Teller on Broadway is at the Marquee Theater, running until August 16th. Penn Jillette, thank you so much
for being on our
show again.
Thank you. I'll sing a little doo-wop for you.
Despite the opening line of that song, anyone who first heard Jerome Anthony Gourdin sing it 57 years ago remembers him quite well. Tears of My Pillow was the first hit single by Little Anthony and the Imperials, followed by many others, including Hurt So Bad, Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop, and Going Out of My Head. As one of the few vocal groups from the 1950s to remain relevant throughout the 60s and beyond, Little Anthony and the Imperials still perform today. In Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, a new book written by Arlene Krieger, Mr. Gourdin reflects on his lifetime in music, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today.
Absolute
Hello.
Pleasure. Who was that little kid singing that a minute ago? He's so cutie. I really like that record. I got to get that.
When you hear that, do you think, gee, that was me?
It's like going in a time capsule. You know, yeah, literally. I go, oh, my gosh. Yeah, I was a kid. I was 17 years old when that was done. I'm 74 now. And I'm listening to my voice, and I'm going, oh, no, I wouldn't have done it that way now, you know, that kind of thing. That's what Sinatra said. Same thing. All singers tend to be very critical of themselves.
You know? Well, are you still singing, I imagine, in a falsetto?
Not really. The falsetto thing came from a song I did called Just the Kinds of People in the World. It was a chorus song where the group sings all the lead choruses. I didn't know what to do. So I just started doing the, you know, all that kind of stuff. And people tend to think that's what I do.
That was the flip side of Tears of My Pillow.
On Tears of My Pillow. Yeah, I actually sing in a high C.
You had two hits on that one record.
Yeah. I sing in a high C, more natural than anything else. And once in a while, I may do it, you know.
So you're just a natural tenor.
Natural tenor.
You write that when you were growing up in Brooklyn, you were surrounded by music.
Yeah.
What were you hearing?
Well, my mom was a gospel singer. And she sang with my aunts, my aunt Sarah, my aunt Bessie, and then my godmother Hilda.
And where did they sing?
They sang gospel in churches all around the tri-state.
Like the Washington Temple.
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Jersey, the tri-state area. And they were called Nazareth Baptist Gospel Singers. That's easy for me to say. And actually, the church that we went to was called that. So they just took that name and made them. And out of that, I met some great gospel singers.
And you also did some singing in the church, which was not surprising. So many R&B singers
say about 90% of us, I don't care who it is, we all came out of that church system, and that's really our school. That's where we really learn our craft.
You mean singing in the
church.
School?
No, in the church. Because in the church, it's really about the experience that you're having spiritually, basically emotional. When you hear Aretha Franklin sing, man, I mean, come on, it just tears you through you. Some singers do that, and I guarantee you they've come out of the church, and they've gotten that very special gift to be able to express themselves emotionally in a way that it gets to you and me and a bunch of other people.
But you also describe the Saturday night parties that you attended with your parents.
Yeah.
So well, Saturday night before the Sunday church?
Yeah. I just thinking about it. Well, you know, in those days, families lived in the same area, literally in the same city, you know, cousins, and everybody. There were so many of us. Today it's all nuclear. Everybody's spread out all over the place. But then we were all in the same area in New York City, Brooklyn, Harlem. And my parents came from the South. And traditionally it was all about food, gathering of the family. So traditionally every weekend just about. You know, you get together, and they would put all the records on, you know, like the Five Royales and all this, and dance, and go, you know, just, they were blue-collar people, and that was a way they could release their stress, you know, and it was fun.
And when you started singing with your friends, who influenced you?
Oh, my goodness. A bunch of people.
Well, there were a lot of doo-wop groups. Do you like the word doo-wop?
No, because I'm not a doo-wop singer. Never was, never will be. I'm not putting anybody down for that. But the problem is that that was a broad stroke, a brush stroke. In 1973, I think it was Gus Gossage, I hope it's him, who was a disc jockey here in New York City. And that was the dawn of disco, as I was told. And he was just telling his audience, you know, what it was like in those days. And he didn't have any way to explain it. And what he thought of, let me put it this way. There were two types of singing groups in those days. There were the black groups who sung basically R&B and, you know, the whole thing, some churchy, some this, that, and that. And then you had the white groups, the Elegants, the Duprees, I can just name them.
The Chuckles. With
Chuckles was different. They were a pop group. They were strictly a pop group. But these were kids who created their own sound because they couldn't emulate what we were doing. They couldn't get that soul feeling, so they started their own thing. Ba, 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 baran, you know, do, wop, do, wop, do, wop, do. And this jockey, I probably had no reference, and he just came out of the top of his head. You know, oh, doo-wop. What happens? And then they stroke us all. That would do a disservice to the late, great Teddy Randazzo and Don Costa and all these wonderful people.
Well, we'll get to Teddy in a moment.
Yeah.
But I assume that you started singing with school friends on the corners and in hallways.
That's what we
did. Like everybody else?
Yeah, that's what we did.
So how did you come to make your first records? You were at End Records, not the biggest label at the time.
Yeah, it was the biggest independent label. It was a lot like Motown in its time. It was actually, they were being distributed by not a regular big company. I don't know how they did it, but End was just the beginning of the Little Anthony Imperials having a big hit record. But I was recording ever since I was 14 years old. And in fact, I've been in the business now for 60 years.
So before you went to End, you were at other...
Oh, my gosh.
With similar groups?
Different groups. I was with a group that was created in Boys High School where I went, and they were called the DuPonts, and they didn't know what to call themselves. One day we were passing the DuPont factory, and we're okay, we're the DuPonts. So we sang with them, and the odd thing about it was some wonderful people was in that group that went on to go different ways, who wanted to sing with us, man. I mean... The ball player, Tommy Davis, used to sing. We were all singing in the cafeterias when we were kids. He was 1 year up above me. 2 years up above me was the great Connie Hawkins. So with all these people were in the... We don't know we're going to be who we're going to be. We're kids. We're in high school. And we would sing together, meet each other, and sing in the lunchroom to pass time. And that's how it went down.
Do you remember recording Tears in My Pillow and then Two People in the World?
Absolutely. Two People in the World was just was supposed to be the A side. Now, if the audience out there can't remember, you can do that with 45s and 78s now, two side hits. Today it's only one side.
But they actually used to put the letters A and B
them. A and B side, A side. So the A side was supposed to be just kind of people in the world, but Mr. Goldner, George Goldner, was the president of End. He
also had G Records.
Yeah, he had a bunch of them. He was in partnership with Morris Levy, who was Roulette Records, okay?
We won't talk about the mob connections.
Let's pass. I got a lot. That's in the... Yeah, well, anyway. And so he had this song. He didn't like the second song we were doing. And he said, guys, that's not doing it. And he said, you remember that song I gave you, Tears in My Pillow? And I vaguely remembered it. I remember the melody. And I said, yeah. He said, I want you to go and rehearse this. Well, we take a break because we were recording, a band break. And we didn't know what to do. So the Imperials went in one room, and I went in another room. And he gave me the lyric, and I just went over and over, and I happened to remember the melody. And then the guys, they didn't know what to do. So they remember, I don't know who it was in the group, I remember the song Earth Angel by the Penguins. So he figured out, well, look, Earth Angel, Earth Angel, you don't remember me? We borrowed it, or they did. And that's how we threw it together. Best is history.
And you can't predict what's going to become a hit. That must have been a big surprise that it did so well so quickly.
I think that George Goldner had an inkling of he's seeding something. We call people like that, like Clyde Davis and them, record men. Certain in those days, there were people who were really keen on what was going on. They just had that wonderful air. They couldn't sing, but they can hear. But they also, I think he knew there was something special about that song.
They also gave you more production than a lot of the other groups of the time. You had strings, you had timpani later.
Yeah, that came later on. And in 58, we were like every other group, any other person singing rock and roll or rhythm and blues. We were like four-piece. You got two tracks in those days. Mm-hmm. Bam was on one track, we were on another track. So it was that way. It wasn't until 1964 when we hooked up with Teddy Randazzo, because Don Costa was recording Frank Sinatra. So actually it made sense to use the same orchestra. So I got to see some of the greatest people in the world, musicians, and we started doing that. We weren't the only group that did that. There was one more group called the Drifters. Stan Applebaum was doing their music really huge with violins and stuff. We really changed the business. And I think we saved ourselves, Dionne Warwick, because at that time the English invasion was coming in. And everybody else fell by the wayside, not us. Because we were doing something so unique and different with violins and timpanis and stuff that the people just hung on to us.
My guest is Little Anthony, and we have a book here called Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, written by Arlene Krieger. It is published by Mascot
out of Washington, D.C., yeah.
And it has lots of wonderful pictures in it as well. Too bad it doesn't have a record, but people can get those records still. They're
sure
all available.
Somewhere they can find them.
And we're going to take a little break and come back with more right after this. We are back with Little Anthony, who is the subject of a book called Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny. Arlene Krieger is the author, and it's published by Mascot Books. Now, you could have called yourself Little Jerome.
Hope not. Goodness sakes.
Did people call yourself Anthony?
No. Alan Freed hooked up on it. Let me tell you a story about that. That's legend says that a record promoter came into the record company and to Gone and End Records and played it. No, I mean, he went from Gone and End Records. He went over to WINS, the old Winds, now the news station here in New York, and that's where Alan Freed was. And he would listen to the records. And it was that day. He had a listening day, it was called, you know. And he said, oh, that's a great record. Who's that girl, man? So the promoter said, it's not a girl. It's a guy. He said, oh, my goodness. He said, he must be very little. What's his name? Jerome Anthony Gordine. He goes, Little Anthony. And he started saying Little Anthony Imperials. And in fact, there's some record collectors has the original Imperials. They had to reprint and put Little Anthony Imperials, and that separated me from that.
People forget how powerful Alan Freed was in the business at that time. But often you had to slip him a little bit of money to get your records played.
Well, things are, you know, yeah, in those days of a reward, no one knew who that was. And I think they had it in for him. There were forces that were trying to destroy him, really, literally.
You performed around the country once that became a hit, part of the Caravan of Stars tour. And your first tour of the Deep South was called Biggest Show of Stars.
Mm-hmm.
Who was on it?
Irving Felt. His son is now runs the Ringling Brothers Bonham & Bailey Circus. And it was all basically black shows. We played the South. And that was my first introduction to a world that I absolutely hated at that time. And segregation hit me right in the face like a windstorm. I didn't really experience that. There were subtleness as living in Brooklyn, New York, but nothing as blatant as that.
Your parents hadn't told you that there'd be whites-only signs?
No. My parents protected me. They came out. I used to hear little stories. I heard about my aunt, one of my aunts talked about how they were run out of Savannah, Georgia, where their father owned all this land, and he was tricked, they said, by this white landowner, somebody, and when he died, they cast him out. So they got together, these girls, their mother had died, my aunts told me, and then they took a ship, a steamship, second class, to New York City from Savannah. And they went up and they settled in New York City. And they're not the only one. That's a story of any blacks going out south will tell you how they migrated, trying to find a better life for their families.
Now, you were doing the Chitlin' Circuit.
You did that.
Which, which was mostly black audiences. Mm-hmm. But you say it could get kind of rough. Weren't places like Baltimore and Philadelphia especially dangerous for performers?
Big time, man. They had them in gangs, man, you know. And we're kids, remember, and they know it. And then the little girls liked us. So there were some incidents. I mean, actually, one time somebody threw a bottle, hit the guitar player's guitar. And, I mean, it splattered all over the place. Then that could have hurt somebody, you know. And they were just rough. It was these theaters. This was in the hood, as we call it, and it was just these kids were troublemakers. Not was just black kids. There were some places where white kids was just as bad. But and basically, that particular theater, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, was not a very pleasant place for me. I didn't look forward to it. I like Philadelphia. I like Washington D.C. Uptown Theater in Philadelphia. You know, I liked all those kind of places, man, that were cool. State Theater in Richmond, Virginia. But you still was in the South. I mean, you start going down in there. And that was the first time I seen the sign said it was in a park, colored drinking water, colored. And I looked, I said, what? And then we went to the show one day, and I'm used to going in the show. And the steps said colored area, section. And it was up on the balcony. And I started to feel this really deep-seated fear that I never felt in my entire life. You got to understand, I came out of a very protective family, a hard, strong family unit, and that was pretty tough for me.
But you made a specialty of singing these sad songs, these songs about jilted lovers, and I'm on the outside looking in.
You really, it wasn't me, it was Teddy Randazzo. Poor Teddy. He was a handsome devil. Italian stallion. You know, he was just like, women were attracted to him. But there was a certain amount of women were attracted to him, and he was attracted to women he shouldn't deal with. And he had one failed relationship after another, and one particular one was a wife he really, really loved, where he had his first daughter. In fact, I keep contact with her sometimes on Facebook, and she's in Hollywood now, growing up. But yeah, it was a very interesting time. It really was.
The group broke up not, what, 3 or 4 years after you started? Why?
Well, yeah. Well, because we had run the course of that world. You know, Tears in My Pillow, Shimmy Shimmy Cocoa Bop was a novelty song. And we, so many things that we miss. Neil Sedaka, who I'll be seeing pretty soon, wrote a song called The Diary for us. And he was just a little writer then. You can tell this is a winner. You know, it's just one of those songs. And there were some problems at record company, and it was released. Richard Bad released the song he wanted. He wrote it, so I'm assuming he's thinking, "Well, we're hot, you know. He can ride that crest." And Mr. Golden was in England promoting records, and he didn't know about it. He left strict instructions to release The Diary, but they released so much, and then it began that momentum that we had waned off.
Well,
and it got very depressing.
But then you got back together.
Yeah, you know, we always were friends. We were kids. We came up together in the street. We're like a band of brothers.
Didn't you pass up an opportunity to open for the Beatles at Shea Stadium?
Oh, we did a lot of stupid stuff. We did a lot of stupid stuff. No, we didn't know. In fact, one of the guys said, man, we got going out of my head. You got all these big songs. What do we got to open for some bugs, you know? Because, you know, if you remember that time, they say the Beatles are coming, the Beatles are coming. It'd be on the subways. No one knew who any Beatles was. But they had such a great public relations team. They put Epstein, their manager, put together. He was a marketer, you know. A lot of people don't know that's what he was before he managed them. Happy, they call him. And he just it was wonderful. And by the time they got here, man, they convinced everybody that it was the greatest time in the world about to happen, and it did. And they asked us, George Harrison was a fan, can we get Little Anthony and Pierce to open for us? We said, I ain't going to open for them. Well, they should be opening for us. And that's the attitude we had. It was so stupid.
Well, you are very open about some of the problems you had, drugs and alcohol, but obviously you've gotten past that. You do tell some hilarious stories here. When you became a solo artist early in your career, you did a week-long engagement at the Brown Derby Club in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, yeah. And John Gotti's mother was in the audience.
Oh, boy, yeah. I didn't know. You know, you take a gig. A gig is a gig. And it's the Brown Derby in Bay Ridge, right off the Verrazano Bridge in that area. It's a very Italian neighborhood, basically. And it happens to be one of the places that, the the gang, Colby, would live, you know. And it happened to be the Gambino family's people. That family was there, and that was Gotti. And the club was run by them. So I went in, you know, rehearsing everything, and then I says, well, where's the dressing room? And they said, the kitchen. And I said, I'm not going to no kitchen. I got about a $2,000 suit here, and all that grease, people running around, hey, all of that, with the spaghetti and this and that, and the balls, the grease going everywhere. I'm not going in there. But I didn't know. And they look at me, these two guys, they say, hey, you got a problem with that? I said, I do. I really do. I can't dress in there. So I guess it got out to Mrs. Gotti, who was in the club, I guess, you know, working in there or something. I can't remember. She's the biggest fan in the world. And so all of a sudden this guy comes and says, Mrs. Gotti says, give him what he wants. So what they did was they took me all the way over where the Verrazano Bridge was and this hotel. It wasn't until I got there that I realized, oh, my goodness, what did I do? You know? One of the guys was Willie Weiss. He plays with me a lot today. He was on that show. He said, man, do you know who those people are? I said, no.
We don't have enough time to go over some of the other things that I want to talk about, like being present at a recording session in Jamaica was
greatest
Bob
thing
Marley
could ever happen.
Saying, no woman, no cry.
Yes.
Watching the George Foreman fight with Elvis Presley.
Yes.
Bruce Springsteen did a warm-up for you.
He didn't warm up. I got to straighten that out. He didn't warm up. What it was he was on the same show on Route 46 when it had about 1,000 nightclubs going on there. He was on the show, and the Dupree's were on the show. Okay, little Stevie Van Zandt wasn't with him yet. I think he's still with the Asbury Dukes. So I remember Max Weinberg. I remember it's clear. I said, what is that guy doing on the drums? He looks like a lawyer. He don't like no drummer. In fact, I found out he was studying in law for law.
Do you ever get together with the Imperials? Because I know you did for American Bandstand.
When we were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that got together. And I actually own the whole thing now. There's only one original left, and that's Ernest Wright. He's the last one. But we've had so many different people in the band. It's hard to people. I don't think people even realized it. But that's it. He's the survivor of the Imperials. Obviously, I'm still Little Anthony. And I do one-man shows. I got one coming up in Suffolk. At the Suffolk Theater in
Riverhead.
Yeah, I'm doing that. And that's just piano playing me, and I tell stories and, you know, stuff like that.
And we have information about that show, Little Anthony, An Evening of Story and Song at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead, Long Island, on July 25th. That's at 8 p.m. We have information about that on our show page at WNYC.org. There are a lot of wonderful stories in this book. Great pictures.
Yeah.
And my great thanks to Little Anthony, who is here to talk about Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, written by Arlene Krieger and published by Mascot Books. And let's listen to a little more of Little Anthony and the Imperials.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.